one is, now I'm trying to think. If I remember correctly, I think to get an accurate reading, you also need a 50-ohm termination on, well, it depends on the meter. Some of them have it built in. But, yeah, he could do that.
Hey, I'm going to pass it over to you, Wes. You're in turn going to, when you're finished, you're going to pass it over to John. I'm going to be away from the microphone for about a minute and a half. You're going to finish with John. John's then going to begin the mailbag. In about a minute and a half, I'll be back. You guys have got some guesses as to what's going on, and you're probably right. I'll be back. I'll have my handy talkie with me, so I'll hear everything you're saying, John. NQXJN to take it. He's going to pass it over to KCWGB. K2RIW is going to be quiet for the next minute and a half. You got it, Wes.
NQXJN. Well, I don't have a good power meter, but I do have a grounded spectrum analyzer which has a built-in power measurement feature. I didn't use it till now, and I have a filter at which I can narrow the signal to the point of interest and measure the particular power out of it. So, yeah, it's good. I completely forgot that I have that attenuator on it. And when Todd was in my place, I was tuning it at first to maximum output. Yeah, what I could do, either use this one, or just make it in the average, so the frequency of interest would be somewhere between 300 to 500 megahertz for Coleman investigation. Then I would connect that to the attenuator, but not the tuner attenuator, the fixed the switches-based attenuator to the spectrum analyzer, and then I don't have to terminate if I'm right. So please correct me. And thank you.
You can use that, let me see, you have a K attenuator, I believe, which goes to... I think it was 50 dB. You could use that in series. Now, what are you going to use this thing you're purchasing? That's going to be used as a linear amplifier for your experiment?
That's correct. The K1 is 20, 20, 20, 30, 20, 10, 5. 20, 2, and 2, something like that. So it's plenty of attenuation there. Yes, what I need to do is do not really go 200 watts, I don't need that. Drive the generator, so I have an output 20 watts, but this thing is 100 watts at max.
Well, what you can do so you can't make a mistake is put minimum attenuation so you have maximum signal, and then put your K attenuator in series with it and leave that as your selection. This way it can't accidentally, if the piston slides in or something like that, and damage anything. That's the way I would go, because that attenuator, the piston attenuator, has a knurled locking ring. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It clockwise will tighten it where it won't move. You could lock it in the exact position you want.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Wes. Let me drop it. Your amplifier is capable of 100 watts of output. And in my mind, at VHF, UHF frequencies, 100 watts is beyond the threshold where you could do a little bit of a human biohazard. Do you own a 100 watt dummy load? Are you going to temporarily put the 100 watts into some kind of an antenna? Or, if you intend to apply the 100 watts to your experiment, which I think is a coaxial fed cable going to the two ends of the glass vial, you know, the center conductor goes to one end, the shield goes to the other end, and until you know the impedance of your experiment, the portion of your experiment where you're about to pour 100 watts into it, until you know its approximate impedance, and this is the best of all worlds, it would act like a 50-ohm resistor. But if in turn it acts like either a short circuit or an open circuit or a pure capacitor, your 100-watt amplifier, if it's tube type, no problem. If your 100-watt amplifier is solid state, and if it's feeding a load that's very far away from 50 ohms, and it's feeding a load that's not capable of absorbing 400 watts, then there's a slim chance you could do some damage here. So what will be the first load on your 100-watt amplifier when you're testing its integrity? In the best of all worlds, you'd be going through a Berg wattmeter into a 100-watt dummy load just to confirm the amplifier before you applied it to your experiment. That would be the best way to do it, just to be real sure. Into XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Interesting. I have a dummy load, but it's approximately 30 inches by 10 inches by 10 inches. It's probably about good 1,500 watts. It's a commercial one. But what am I going to connect? Well, the coupling between the object of test is going to be air. So that means I need to use any kind of antenna. There would be small in diameters and would work from 100, no, it's not 100 kilohertz. The Coleman frequency of call was 300 megahertz. I was able to reach the activation of the company at 430 megahertz. And I would like to sweep now. Somewhere from 200 megahertz to 500 megahertz and find out at very small power what is the frequency of activation.
Okay, the fact that you own something like a 1,000 watt or 1,500 watt dummy load, 50 ohm dummy load, very good news. So you've got the right load for the amplifier of the first confirmation test of the amplifier. You want to find out the amplifier really does have something like 40 to 45 decibels of gain, and it really does have something like 100 watts of output. So taking the output of the amplifier, applying it to the dummy load, very good test. Now, if in the way you apply it to the dummy load, it could first go through a Berg watt meter and then the dummy load, and the Berg watt meter would tell you in the forward mode you're getting 100 watts, and the reverse mode you're getting 1 watt reflected from your dummy load. That would be ideal if you owned a Berg watt meter, or in the case of some commercially made dummy loads, there is a sampling port on the dummy load. There's another connector which has, we'll say, a 30 decibel attenuator, and therefore each watt you put into the dummy load would give you 1 milliwatt coming out of the sampling port on the dummy load. So my next question is, does your dummy load have a sampling port? Do you own a Berg watt meter? What is your method of confirming that you're getting 100 watts output? The worst situation would be you apply 100 watts for 10 minutes and you measure the temperature rise of the dummy load with an accurate thermometer and do a telemetry experiment. That would be difficult, but it would at least get you in the ballpark. So as you can tell, now that I know you've got a good dummy load, my next question is, what's your confirmation process to confirm that something in the vicinity of 100 watts can come out of that amplifier? N2XJN, K2.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
N2XJN, K2RIW, wait for the before beam, sir. Go ahead, Wes.
Unfortunately, I'm very much equipped with low frequency hardware, but I was never high frequency or even HF range guy, so I don't have a bird. I don't have a power meter. I do have the feature on my spectrum analyzer, which is a power measurement on it. With the right attenuator, I'll be able then to scale it to the point at which I'll have a proper reading. Enter XVM.
C3, repeat that with info.
Scott recognized, and I'll get you in a minute, Scott. The fact that you've got a attenuator that you can put between the 100-watt amplifier and the 1,500-watt dummy load, that's not enough, because very few step attenuators, very few attenuators can tolerate 100 watts. Another way of doing it would be with a directional coupler. And the directional coupler, John owns quite a few of these.
I have them.
The directional coupler doesn't even have to be rated for that frequency. There's ways you can calibrate and calculate what the directional coupler is telling you. So the next step would be a directional coupler into many of your pieces of instrumentation, power meters, spectrum analyzer, and so on. But let's see what Scott's got to say about this. Those guys up there in Canada, they know how to measure high power. Now, VE3ZTZ in the Toronto area, I believe, K2RIW. Go ahead, Scott.
Good evening to all. Hope you're having a great weekend. Spring has finally sprung up here, so we're just starting to enjoy it a bit. I have a dummy load, and the circuit board came off the internet. It has a high wattage diode inside the mineral oil bath, and a picofarad, a couple of picofarad capacitor, I forget the value, across the mineral. You put a digital voltmeter across that, take your reading, and use the root mean square formula, which is also published with the schematic, and you have you have a watt meter, power meter, good to your 50 ohm dummy load.
Okay. Now, what that's called a sniffer circuit, by adding a sniffer circuit, a sampling circuit, to the fluid environment of your dummy load, by making a modification of the dummy load, you can make it a power sampler by way of the crystal detector you put in there and the coupling wire you put in there and the nearness of that coupling wire. Some number of volts of output of the crystal detector represents so many watts of input. It does require some careful construction. It does require a calibration procedure. You said there is a published circuit on that one. Where would I go to find that published circuit, Scott? What was the website or your search word that you used to find that magic circuit? VE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just trying to look that up for you now. As soon as I find it, I'll get back to you on the net. VE3ZTZ.
Well, actually, what you could do is find me in QRZ.com and send any commercial. You can send it to John or Dick at what we talk the next time. So, thank you very much. I do appreciate it, Dick.
Yeah, each of the circuits that I have published, my 1,000-watt amplifier from 432, the K2RIW strip-line parallel kilowatt amplifier, April and May issue of QST Magazine, did have a power output indicating circuit. It was just a little bit of a sniffer wire going into a crystal diode that went through a resistor and went to the front panel meter. And so it was a relative power meter, not exact in power output in watts. So each of my two published transmitter articles did have a power output indicator, which was a very simple circuit, a dollar's worth of hardware, not counting the meter itself. And the meter was there for a whole bunch of other reasons, with a rotary switch to select the meter function. So with the right kind of a recommended schematic, getting a relative power meter function added to your dummy load is a definite capability. I'd be a little bit reluctant to take a commercially made... Let me drop...
Seven.
Yeah, we heard you, Scott. I'd be a little bit reluctant to take a commercially made, nicely designed 1,500-watt dummy load and take it apart and make this modification. I'd be a little bit reluctant to do that. I would much rather see a person use a directional coupler that he puts in front of it, and that way you're not modifying this beautiful dummy load. I'd rather see a person do it with a directional coupler. John knows how to do that and how to calibrate the procedure. See, if you set up a directional coupler so that it is acting as a 30, 40, or 50 decibel attenuating coupler on the coupled port, but the straight-through port is giving you the full 100 watts passing straight through, that would be the best of all worlds. And there is a calibration procedure that would allow you to figure out what you read out of the directional coupler and what it means coming out of the amplifier. But Scott has found the article, which is just one more reference that'll help. DE3ZTZ, after the four beeps, K2LIW. Go ahead, Scott.
I do believe Wesley has a 30 dB coupler at that frequency range.
Okay. A 30 dB coupler would take 100 watts down to 100 milliwatts, and 100 milliwatts is possibly troublesome depending on what instrumentation he uses. Most of it, Scott's got the BE3ZTZ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay, so everyone's got their pen and paper ready for a copy. It's a short and fairly easy one, but everyone's at the ready. It's k4echoalphaalpha.com/dummy.html. So I'll say again, www.k4echoalphaalpha.com/dummy.html. I built one of these. I enjoy it. And I use a digital voltmeter in the formula that they prescribe. And it seems to give very accurate readings for me. D3ZZ.net.
Additional comment, Dick.
Very, very fine, Scott. Before I go back over to John, Scott, that K4 Echo Alpha Alpha circuit, do you believe it could be built into a separate box out in front of the dummy load, or do you believe it must be contained inside of the dummy load according to the way the author recommended using it? If it's something that can be built outside, that would be the best of all worlds. So Wes, to dig inside of his 1500-watt fluid-cooled dummy load, that's getting into a little bit more serious surgery, in my opinion. So do you think it could be built as a separate outboard circuit? DE3ZTZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, you've got the article, Building a Dummy Load and Measuring Power Accurately. It's very interesting. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. But isn't it that easier would be to go with directional coupler with 30 dBs of 100 watts, giving you 100 milliwatts out?
Yeah, hold on a minute, Wes. Let's let Scott answer that question. Scott, do you believe that that circuit could be built as outboard of the dummy load itself? DE3ZTZ, Scott, to take it. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I think you could, with a T adapter in line, that you could take the diode and the capacitor across the T and use the T point as to take the digital voltmeter reading. I think it could be done that way.
Okay, understand, Scott. John, with your 30 dB directional coupler that Wes already has, that would bring his 100 watts down to 100 milliwatts, and some instrumentation would be troublesome to measure 100 milliwatts without additional padding. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, he has an HP432D, like I do, with a bolometer and the cable, and he can attach that right to the directional coupler.
Okay, his particular directional coupler, which you said is a 30 dB coupler, what is its frequency region? Because although some of his measurements are going to be 200 to 500 megahertz, there is a possibility he wants to go all the way down to 100 kilohertz, which he can do, but now it requires a little more mathematics to use your directional coupler that far out of its frequency region, which I've often done, and it can be calibrated. So his directional coupler, you would trust it over what frequency region, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Dickie has several. I believe he has one that's set for 500 megahertz, so that's good enough. He's going to be swinging between, I don't think he'll go any lower than 300. He'll sweep from 300 to 500, and that bolometer instrument will give him accurate readings.
And just to be double-dot sure, there's a way of calibrating the directional coupler. Now this week I was very disappointed to find out that the K5RMG, the Roadrunners Microwave Group, which for the last 10 years has had a technical section on their website in which 10, count them, 10 of my articles, the K2RIW corner was there, and lots and lots of people I've referred to the K5RMG Roadrunners Microwave Group of Southern Texas, I think it is, or Northern Texas, not sure which. I've referred them to those articles. And foolish me, I didn't download those articles and store them away on my desktop or whatever. Some of those articles I wrote 10 years ago. I've spent a ridiculous number of hours looking back into my archives to find the original article, because they've now updated their website. It's a lot more modern looking, but they've eliminated that section. I hope they've only done that temporarily, but there's a K2RIW article that used to be for 10 years on the Roadrunners Microwave Group website on their technical section, where it gives you a very detailed calibration procedure for using a directional coupler. Let me drop.
K2YO.
Okay, Bernie recognized, as I said, that article on the Roadrunners Microwave Group by K2RIW gave you a very elaborate, fairly well-described alignment procedure for directional couplers. How do you calibrate? How do you use them way outside of their frequency region in a manner that can be traced to good metrology practices, if you know what I mean. So I hope they're going to restore those articles. Now, Bernie, being as smart as he is, there's a chance he's already downloaded those articles, and he's got a copy of them, and he can save me a mountain of work. Let's see if Bernie has done that. If so, I'm going to give him a great big fistful of dollars and shake his hand and be very happy. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, Dick, I haven't downloaded them yet, but can you give me the website address of where it used to be?
Absolutely. It used to be in the old days, www.K5RMD, K5 Romeo Mike Golf, which stands for Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG.org. It's now become .com, but it's K5RMG.org. And then once you're on their main page, there was a square you clicked on that said technical articles. You went to that, click on, and you go to the bottom of that page, and there were 10 articles there by K2RIW. It was called the K2RIW Corner. So that's what it was up until, I think, a couple of months ago. And they've changed that website. The K5RMG.org is no longer in existence. It becomes .com automatically. And their brand new, beautiful-looking front page no longer contains those technical articles. And I'm very disappointed. They were giving me a great service all these years. I can't complain. The price was right. But I wasn't smart enough to download those articles myself. I had written some of them at the salt mine on that computer system 14 years ago, two employers ago, on their email system, I wrote that article. You can see how difficult it's going to be for me to find the original. K2 Yankee Oscar. Need a fill? K2LIW in the tech net.
DE3ZTZ info.
Okay, Bernie first, and then I'll go over to Scott in that order. Bernie, go ahead.
Negative on the field, Dick, but you are buying coffee at field day, because I'm looking at them right now, and I'm going to figure out what's the best way to capture them and get them over to you. K2 Oscar.
Whoa, how did you do that? It's no longer there. Do you have some kind of an archival retrieval system where you're taking a snapshot of the whole Don internet and you can go back in time? Do you have a time machine? How the hell did you do that, Bernie?
He's an alien.
Alien Bernie. How the hell did you do that? Are you allowed to give us this secret, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar? You're going to get a pot full of coffee, K2 LIW.
Well, it's easy. I contacted the aliens that wiped out Lou NY2H's memory and had them put me in their time machine. So there's a thing called the Wayback Machine. If you go to archive.org on the internet, www.archive.org, you can plug in a website and it will tell you basically this is a group. I don't know where they get their funding, but basically they are archiving the entire internet. Not all sites are archived, but the good news is that your site is.
Well done. I never heard about that. Fantastic. So we can go back in time. Let's see how the guys up in Canada would solve that one. DE3ZTZ, K2RAW. Go ahead, Scott.
KC2QAQ with the cabin.
Scott first, and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Scott.
I was interrupting with that same piece of information, so you have it. Google has equivalent pages as well. It's, you put the word cache, C-A-C-H-E colon, in front of the URL that you're looking for. And basically, if they've ever searched it, they've already got it. And if it's if there's 10 versions of the page, because there's been edits to it, it'll also, the Google one will show you the versioning. So there's those two sources. DE3ZTZ.
Even though you guys are ham, you're all right. I knew that the internet was capable of a lot of stuff. There's a lot of information. And Google, obviously by what Google did by that game that they play. Why can't I think of the name of the game? You know what I'm talking about. Jeopardy. The way they can play Jeopardy. They taught a machine with artificial intelligence. Google did that. Wow. Okay. Let's see what John would have done in this one. I mean, Glenn. KC2QIQ. K2IW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, just the comments about the internet, Dick. When something goes on the internet, it's on there forever. It never goes away. And there's nothing that's erased, because if you look at the way the architecture of the internet works, it basically just connects from one server to another server to another server. The only thing that changes over time is how things are addressed. So in other words, if you want to make a link no longer available to everybody, basically you just change the addressing of the website. But basically, that information is still there. You can always get to it if you know how to address something. So all of this other company is doing is basically archiving the new address or the new home for that website. But it's always on there. It never goes away. K2SW, K2QIQ.
That's awful good to know. So if a person puts, if a person gets a risque picture of you, for instance, puts it on the internet, and you then come along and say, I want to erase it, and you're in a heap of trouble. How do you erase all of those archives and all of those machines throughout the world so it lasts forever?
I think I have an additional question about the antenna that I should use for the experiment.
I was getting to that, and that's a big one. Let me drop. Under normal circumstances, a person builds an antenna because he wants to radiate a signal out into the universe. One of the clients I worked for once actually wrote a specification saying they wanted full performance of an antenna out to 10 feet, and then they wanted the signal to abruptly drop to zero at 10 feet. That was the specification. This company was about to issue that to have people bid on it to vendors in the United States. And I told them, you've got to not do that, because if you do, they will be laughing up their sleeve about you for the next 10 years. You can't do that. Once you launch a signal, a radio signal, unless you're doing it from inside of a screen room or an anechoic chamber, it's going to go to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. That's just the way radio behaves once you've launched it. Now, in your particular case, you're trying to launch a signal not to the universe. You want to launch a signal into what's usually called the reactive near field, within a few inches of your equipment. That's a very different antenna. You're trying to build, oh, I guess some people would call it a load cell. You're building a miniature microwave oven is what you're really building. And to make an antenna cover even 200 to 500 megahertz, which is more than an octave, it's an octave and a quarter, to do it with good impedance matching and good coupling to your circuit, that is a serious challenge. It's not just simply falling off a log. So you've got an unusual antenna requirement, reasonably broadband, and you want them. You now, let me drop. You're going to have to make a decision about the signal coming out of your transmitter, coming out of your antenna. Do you want it to couple a certain amount of current to your circuit, a certain amount of voltage to your circuit, a certain power flux density in milliwatts per square centimeter?
No. What I need only is to have a reasonable, not really accurate, picture of how much power was delivered to the compound in order to activate it. I found that around 25 watts let me drop. I've got a perfect activation of the compound in the frequency of 430 megahertz, and talking about antenna mismatch, completely, the active power that could accumulate on the compound was probably milliwatts and energy.
Almost all antennas will obey the law of reciprocity. If the antenna itself is well constructed, the antenna, when you apply 100 watts or 10 watts or 1 watt to it, will run ice cold. The antenna itself, if you choose the right materials. After that, the antenna is just a coupling medium into a calorimetry experiment. By way of directional couplers, in the transmission line, between your amplifier and the thing that you call antenna, the electromagnetic transducer, by way of directional couplers, you could measure the amount of forward power being applied, the amount of reflected power that the second directional coupler tells you is coming back from the antenna, because any power that you feed to the antenna that doesn't come back did get radiated by the antenna. Depending on how well shielded your circuitry is, you could assume that all power that went to the antenna that didn't come back got absorbed by the material that's in your shielded circuit. So by way of a pair of directional couplers, knowing reciprocity and knowing calorimetry, you can now calculate with high accuracy how much milliwatts or watts of power did your experiment absorb. But to do that well, it's got to be well shielded. And now you've got a second problem when you do that. Let me drop. Let me give you an example of the problem you might run into. And this was a real situation that I encountered. A group of people I worked with were building a high power, I believe it was a 150 watt amplifier that covered a very large frequency range. It was a tunable cavity, a microwave tube, a 2C39 tube, capable of producing 150 watts across a very broad frequency region. Okay. They didn't have a dummy load that could take the 150 watts. They connected it to a feed horn. And the feed horn, they had a series of feed horns, 15 dB gain feed horns, that were capable of covering that frequency region. At first, they were aiming the feed horns up into the sky and radiating that power. And by way of couplers, they were able to measure what power output was coming from their circuit that they were designing. That worked pretty well. They suddenly realized that some of the frequencies they'd be sweeping across were going to interfere with commercial services. Let me drop. So the next thing they did is say, gee, I don't want to interfere with these commercial services. They were in a heavy industrial environment. There were the equivalent of two-way radios and the cordless phones. There were a whole lot of things being used in that industrial environment, and they know that radiating these 150 watts of signals was going to be creating trouble because they're going to be doing final testing of multiple amplifiers. They're going to build hundreds of these amplifiers, so day in and day out they're going to be radiating these signals, and day in and day out they'll be creating a lot of electromagnetic interference. Somebody got the great idea, hey, we own a screen room. They literally dug a hole into the double screening of the screen room and put a piece of coaxial cable through there, and then they put the feed horn in the screen room. They said, gee, now that I've got this way of radiating the signal, but I don't want it to get to the outside world, I'll radiate the signal into the screen room. Sounds good on paper until you suddenly realize what's going on here. The screen room is like a microwave oven. The screen room, if it's built correctly, doesn't allow any signal to get out to the outside world. Therefore, the signal you put into the cable, into the feed horn, into the microwave horn in the screen room, the signal is going to reflect back and forth across all of those walls of the screen room and come right back to the horn. The bottom line was this beautiful horn that had a very low standing wave ratio, when it radiated a signal up into the sky, inside of the screen room, the horn had a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio. You apply 100 watts to the horn, and 98 watts came back to you, because there was no absorber anywhere. So you're going to run into a somewhat similar problem. As you make your circuit better and better shielded, so that you can do the calorimetry experiment, now any power that's not absorbed by your circuit will represent an impedance mismatch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So any power that's not absorbed by your material will represent reflected power back to your amplifier. By way of the directional couplers and by way of testing the accuracy of your shielding of your circuit, you'll be able to quantify these things, but that so-called antenna, what you call antenna, which really is a transducer between your amplifier and the material you're trying to irradiate, you're going to have to go a little bit slow on that one. That's not an easy design, is my understanding. I'm going to pass it over to John and see what his feeling is on this one. So I think you've got to go a little slow on this one. If you want to do a quantitative experiment, there's quite a bit more here than first meets the eye. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Also, Dick, if he's going to use an antenna as the transmitting antenna, without making a direct connection to his device, he's also going to be radiating power into space. Okay, now if he makes his coaxial connections directly to this device, the powder element that's in there has almost an infinite resistance. Now what the impedance is going to be at the frequency, he's going to find out. But I think a lot of it is also going to be noise radiated to space, and that's power. So I think there's going to be a lot of loss there.
First, the assessment of the power influence towards the compound is based on power radiated. So sometimes I would be able to find out, let's say I'm giving right now 3 watts. And based on Coleman, the principles, the reactive power at the buoy was supposed to be the milliwatts on the antenna, which was a compromise antenna, like me that. And it was activated the compound, and the power resonance circuit that was used in the device was really not
contain the compound inside, but the compound was sort of on its side. So the reaction of the compound should be possible in milliwatts, maybe microwatts, of the active power. So I don't really need 100 watts. What I need to do is find the proper frequency for the compound to react, as the one stated in the patent is 300 megahertz.
But also, Dick, just quickly, this device, which is a glass tube with two wire ends, okay, he's trying to find the frequency that's going to activate this compound. But there has to be a load on this eventually, which is going to change the frequency that the compound is going to respond to, I believe. So he's got a long road on this, without a doubt.
Yeah, there's a couple of conflicts of interest here. To efficiently couple power from a 50-ohm signal generator, coaxial-fed 50-ohm signal generator, that's the 100-watt power amplifier that I'm talking about right now. I'm calling it a high-power signal generator. If you had a really wide-range antenna tuner-like structure that could couple a good efficient impedance match into your glass vial of powder with the two metal ends, that's doable. However, because your material in that glass vial is going to react in some way, with high probability, whatever impedance it had in the beginning is going to change. As it changes impedance, it requires readjustment of the antenna tuner, so to speak, if you didn't have an antenna tuner. So there's going to be a kind of a balancing act of how much power, what impedance, what frequency, how much reaction, how much change in impedance, how much readjustment. There's going to be a kind of a balancing act between how you apply the power, how to quantify how much power you applied, how much reaction you got, and how much performance you got. So what you're calling antenna, let me drop. It's a good word to begin to call it antenna. A slightly more accurate word would be calling it electromagnetic transducer. You're taking coaxial RF energy and coupling it into this vial of powdered material. That's not really an antenna. The word antenna usually means you're radiating a signal into free space. That's not what you're trying to do here. You're trying to specifically irradiate a particular vial of materials that has, in the beginning, a mysterious impedance, and most likely that impedance is going to change. It's going to require quite a series of experiments with some reasonably careful measurements and then analysis of the measurements to figure out what's happening, how much power got coupled in, how much reaction took place, how much impedance variation took place, and how much of the desirable result took place.
Yeah, but Dick, what antenna or what coupling circuit do you propose? Should they use sort of the closed loop in form of the coil? How do I then perform with the frequency range from 200 megahertz to 500 megahertz, knowing that I'm not interested in using 100 watts? Already you've got the confirmation of the compound activation. But the thing is that I want to find was the peak or the peaks of response.
KQ2QIQ would have it. Glenn recognized, but I've got a quick question for Wes first. You are partially duplicating a particular previous patent of, I believe, 1956. Did the patent describe the circuitry, the transducer?
Yes.
Okay. If the patent described the transducer, are you saying you want to do it in a different way than it was done before over the U.S.?
It might be a little bit misunderstanding because it describes the receiving part. It does not describe the transmitting part and the antenna or whatever the coupled circuit. Glenn, pick up.
Yeah. What you're calling antenna here really isn't an antenna. It's a transducer. A transducer is something that takes coaxial-fed electromagnetic energy and applies it to your circuit. It's not trying to radiate into space. That's what an antenna does. You're doing something quite different from an antenna. So the best we could call it is electromagnetic transducer, something that converts the impedance of 50 ohms of the cable to whatever impedance your powder is in that vial, hopefully creates an impedance match at those frequencies. A simple loop is not going to do it very well. And loops at 200 to 500 megacycles built in a 1 or 2 inch or 3 inch diameter are very, very difficult to impedance match. You're at 1% of a wavelength of circumference, if you know what I mean.
Also need to keep it at 10 inches from the compound. I just want to have that physical separation for the presentation.
And also it would be nice if your circuit was in a shielded structure, sort of like a small microwave oven, and now you apply the power to a transducer inside of the microwave oven. So that now it's confined, and you know that any energy that's absorbed could only be absorbed by your powder and not be radiated to space, because if it really was a loosely coupled, 10-inch away, antenna-like structure, maybe only 1% of the power you fed into that antenna-like structure would get into your powder, and the other 99% would go into space, and it's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. Glenn might have a suggestion. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've done a lot of these experiments, Dick, and they're not cheap, unfortunately. They're very expensive measurements to do, but how I've done them in the past is they're usually part of what are called immunity specifications. In other words, you basically want to apply RF over a group of frequencies onto a test object and see how immune it is to RF energy. And this is done for, a lot of times you'll see done to just a lot of products to make sure that the product doesn't get interfered with as it gets hit with a certain amount of CW energy. And how it's generally done, when you let it drop.
By the way, in your company, they probably use the word immunity. In the company I worked at, they called it susceptibility. Very similar word. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, depending on which spec you pick up, sometimes it's called susceptibility, sometimes it's called immunity. So depending on whether you're talking about, which standard and, how you're describing the experiment. But like you're saying, it's really the same basic thing. And how it's generally done is a lab amplifier is used. That's an amplifier that usually can withstand very, very broad impedance changes, very high VSWRs into 50 ohms. So in other words, even though the output of the amplifier is generally 50 ohms, it can sustain very, very high VSWR and can drive all kinds of crazy antennas and crazy impedances. And generally what's done is you can set up a test antenna like a Yagi or something else like that, or a loop or whatever you want to connect this energy into, and place it into a chamber that's relatively shielded, like you mentioned before, and then basically use some other device inside the chamber that's measuring the intensity of the energy. So in other words, some kind of a field strength measurement. And you mount the field strength detector very, very close to the object that you're going to basically hit with this RF energy. And when you get the correct amplitudes by adjusting the generator into these odd impedances, this way your amplifier is always protected because it's a lab type that can handle these kinds of impedances. And you can actually very carefully measure the field strength. So it gives you kind of like a closed loop type of measurement, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ, but I'm pretty sure you're familiar with these as well.
And also, I think, I remember the old time when I was young, we've been simply connecting the light bulb into the output of the amplifier to see the power out.
But some of those susceptibility or vulnerability measurements that you've done, were they done with a GTEM? The GTEM is really a very large feed horn-like structure with a great big dummy load at the far end, the very large end. And as such, for his particular experiment, in order to have simultaneous coupling to the material he wants to irradiate, simultaneous shielding to the outside world so that all the energy applied, where it's going, one of the classic techniques that has been done to do this is to put your material into a piece of waveguide. The waveguide with a short circuit at one end and a waveguide to coax adapter at the other end that launches the signal, you now have a very controlled environment where you know exactly what the volts per meter and milliwatts per square centimeter are. And the next question you're going to say is, gee, 200 to 500 megacycles, that's a very large piece of waveguide. Not necessarily. There are ways of building waveguides that works at very low Earth frequencies for a physical size. It's called double ridge waveguide. If you're willing to construct out of sheet metal, it's not going to require a whole lot of it. It can be done with galvanized steel sheet metal. You can build yourself a piece of double ridged waveguide that will simultaneously be a resonant cavity at each of the frequencies you care about, a completely shielded structure, and now the only absorptive material inside of the double ridge waveguide would be the material you wish to irradiate. That double ridge waveguide is simultaneously the transducer, the antenna, the shield. It does everything in one step, if you know what I mean. So that's a possible way. To try to do it with bow ties and dipoles and loops is a very difficult technique, and only 1% of the energy is going to go into the right place. Let me drop. So if you Google the word double ridge waveguide, if you go to the right section of the antenna engineering handbook, which is labeled transmission lines, and there's 15 different kinds of transmission lines, but one of the very exotic broadband, fully shielded waveguide-like transmission lines is either single ridge or double ridge waveguide. Double ridge waveguide is the one that can cover a 10-to-1 frequency region in some cases. And so the waveguide to cover the frequency region, to give you the shielding, to give you the coupling, is a possible approach. I'm not saying it's the most ideal, but it's one worth considering. Anybody want to have a comment on the above? K2LIW and the TechNet. Give me your call letters right now.
Yeah, I have a comment.
And by the way, the double ridge waveguide, which was approximately 2 inches wide and an inch high, that operated from roughly 8 to 20 gigahertz at the multi-kilowatt level, is something that I have used on a particular military project. And you're not up that high in frequency. Your waveguide is going to be a lot bigger, but still, ordinarily waveguide covers a rather narrow frequency region. The beauty of double ridge waveguide is that it becomes much smaller and much broader in frequency response. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I see what you're talking about, but rectangular waveguide with two reaches and the slit on it. For some reason, it reminds me of the double slit experiment. Anyhow, a few words on that structure and eventually how big it is. Now, I have a share. I bought it from the Army base in Utah. So I can cut a metal like a butter. Like a knife is playing with the butter. And any possible shape I want. And so here.
Okay, now you've got a direction. As I see it, the direction you were going before, to put some kind of an antenna, let me pick a number, 10 inches away, means that less than 1% of the radiated power from that antenna was really going to get into your powder, your material under test. And 98% is going to go somewhere else. And as you transmit on those particular frequencies, you're doing a kind of violation of FCC rules. And depending on what frequency you're on, you're going to be interfering with other services. It's a nice shielded structure of double ridge waveguide with a short circuit at one end and the waveguide to coax launching structure, the adapter at the input end, now gives you, as I see it, a potential approach which has the best of all worlds. Complete shielding, complete reciprocity, complete metrology, where you now have a kind of calorimeter in which you will know with measurements of forward power and reflective power on the transmission line going to the waveguide to coax adapter, you will know exactly how much energy you applied to your material in the test. So, you thought this was going to be simple. No problem is simple, as you can tell. Almost everything you do in the real world of physics, if you think the problem is simple, there's a 98% chance you don't understand the problem yet. That's a quote of mine.
Hey, Dick, do you know what level of in volts per meter Wesley needs?
Guarantee he doesn't know yet. He's about to find it. He knows how many milliwatts or watts he wants to apply. And when he eventually finds out what is the apparent impedance between the two ends of that glass tube with metal ends containing the material, he'll eventually find out what its approximate impedance is, and therefore he can figure out with that impedance and with some number of volts per meter that the double reach waveguide will guarantee for you, and how many watts get absorbed. There's ways you can resolve the three equations, three unknowns, if you know what I mean. KCQQIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I can see a whole bunch of issues with these kinds of measurements. I mean, I know that when I've done the immunity susceptibility type of testing, having that performed, it has to be done in multiple axes with multiple polarities, and which generally, like when we do like one of those kinds of tests, the test item is mounted in usually on a test area. That is in one, you set up like three axes, X, Y, and Z. So you place the item on the bench in what you first call like X, and then you do everything in vertical polarization. Then you move it to the Y and Z by rotating the test item. And then after you're done with that, then you flip over to horizontal polarization, and you do those same three orientations again. So in other words, because you have polarization and orientation of the object, that is also going to, it's more than just amplitude, if you follow what I'm saying, Dick. K2RZW, KC2QIQ.
I sure do, Glenn. One of the chambers frequently used for susceptibility immunity testing is a so-called GTEM. G-TEM is the way it's abbreviated. And it's I wish I could think of the name of the company that manufactures this thing. It's an extremely large horn-like structure, but it's completely shielded. It gives you a very pure vertical polarization. Once you know, when you put your object under test in a particular sweet spot of that chamber, you open the door. The chamber itself is about 6 foot high, probably about 10 foot long, left to right, and it's tapered. You got a type N connector at the far end where the taper comes to a very small dimension. And the other end, the open end, is about a 10-foot square. No, it's about a 6-foot square, 7-foot square, with a dummy load material at that end. And you put your material in the middle of this chamber. It gives you an extremely precise, pure vertical polarization of a very well-known volts per meter. And then by the orientation of your device at the test, whether you set it up vertical, horizontal, you align it to the XYZ axis sequentially, and now you know exactly what you're applying. What I was recommending as a candidate structure for Wes is the double ridge waveguide. The double ridge waveguide with his shear is something where he can cut metal, he can cut and bend metal, he can build the thing to an exact design. And just like the GTEM, the double ridge waveguide gives you an extremely predictable voltage field inside of that waveguide. Once that waveguide is working correctly, the double ridge guide, you know exactly how many volts per meter you've got in every square centimeter inside of that double ridge waveguide. And once you apply your material you're testing, and you align it first with the X and the Y and the Z axis and then axes in between, you'll know exactly how many volts per meter you're applying. By way of the amount of watts you put in and the amount of watts that reflects back out, or dBm in, dBm out, you know exactly how much is being absorbed. So it is it's a reasonably well-defined experiment. And I'm recommending that for him, He knows he wants to put all of his power into his material, therefore he's not going to build a G10. He doesn't need the dummy.